Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I was just thinking to myself how we as human beings like to create categories to create a sense of organization and, you know, kind of a sense of stability. And I was thinking, well, here we are on the last full day in the second Dhamma talk that's going to probably focus a little bit on what we take with us from this and how we want to organize the rest of our lives. That's what's supposed to happen on the second Dhamma talk of the day. So now we've created that perception. Everybody can feel secure. And there might be a couple of ways to, you might want to consider spending the next 45 minutes or however long it ends up being that I'm talking. I was really actually quite moved with Lungpa's reflections this morning and his description of right concentration, unification of the mind around the object of cessation of suffering. And if you feel inclined to spend the next 45 minutes with that contemplation, I think that's the best way you can spend the next bit of time. I would do that if I could. An alternative would be that if you have an object of meditation that resonates with you and your mind is settled and wants to just settle with that, that's also a good way to spend the next bit of time. Or you can let your mind drift and fantasize and go off in all sorts of directions, which I wouldn't advise. And if all else fails, then focusing a little bit on some of these reflections and taking what you wish from them, if the meditation doesn't work for you. Just thinking about many of you are quite well-practiced practitioners. Many people who have practiced for many years, some just for a few years, but with a very strong commitment. Maybe even a few of you have been practicing longer than I. But it's always good, I think, towards the end of a retreat, when the mind is starting to try and consolidate and figure out what one might want to take back with an aditana or a determination of how one might adjust one's practice or change one's practice. And just particularly for those who have been practicing a long time, I find it's useful to reflect, and I try and do this periodically myself, on asking oneself the question, am I becoming complacent in my practice? It was a topic I mentioned at a talk at Portland Friends of Dhamma a few months ago, so if you were there, my apologies for repetition here, but I thought it was a useful recollection for myself, and I think it's worth sharing up with others too, because it is easy to, after you've been practicing for a while, the newness maybe wears off a bit, all the fresh blazing insights that one can often have in the first few years of practice aren't quite so predominant anymore. Maybe some of the real gross mind states that we start with have faded a bit with even just keeping precepts and spending a little bit of time with meditation. And we notice those and appreciate those and feel comfortable with those. And in a way, sometimes it can become easy, particularly as time goes on, even longer, to become a bit complacent with feeling better, feeling pretty good. Things aren't so bad, less suffering in my life. Well, maybe that's good enough. But it's really important to remember that the work isn't done until the work is done. And we all do have that potential for a complete realization of the end of suffering. And to hold that goal in at least the back of our minds, if not occasionally bringing it to the fore, as a way of refreshing our inspiration, refreshing our energy, and creating the motivation to keep reviewing where we're at, not in a punitive kind of a way or a self-critical kind of a way, but in a way that can inspire us to keep looking at where we're needing to put energy, where maybe we still operate with some defilement, shortcomings, even if it's more subtle aspects of the practice, whether it's with our precepts or with our meditation or the other aspects of the Eightfold Path. Where can I put some energy, put more effort into increasing wholesome qualities, wholesome states of mind, and letting go, abandoning some of those unskillful ones? And I think for just about everybody, there's a whole wide range of areas in which we can focus our attention to see where it is that maybe we can improve, spend some time, refine our practice. One of the first ways would be with our precepts. Probably most of you, I would guess, attempt to follow the five precepts when you're off of retreat. And on the surface, we take the five precepts, and everybody pretty much knows what they are, I think. And those five precepts, the way they're stated, offer a basic structure for living a harmless life. That's what particularly the first four are structured around, how we can be living without hurting ourselves or hurting other people in very damaging ways. And there's also ways that they can be refined. A lot of the monastic precepts that we follow, the 227 precepts, a lot of the ones that are based in the moral aspects or the sila aspects of the practice are basically refinements on those first four precepts. And then, of course, there's a whole bunch of renunciate precepts and other kinds. But the moral precepts that a monk has or a nun has is our refinements of non-harming in different ways. So those are aspects of the path that as lay people you can also take up and consider. These are not restricted to just monastics. These refinements, if you will, of these precepts. So like the first precept, the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. How is that working out? How is that playing in your life? In the monastic set of precepts, there's a whole series of rules that refer to various details of not taking the life of other creatures, or not even harming. Intentionally harming other creatures, regardless of whether you're taking their life or not. So to reflect on that for yourself, when I was in the household life before I became a monk, I was an avid gardener. And some years before I took ordination, I started to reflect on the five precepts as I came to know them better, and found it quite a challenge, because I had been quite used to feeling okay about, with some discrimination, but taking the life of certain invading insects and critters in the garden, and because they were, you know, eating everything, particularly the things that I wanted them not to eat. And I had vegetables as well as flowers, and after reflecting upon it some time, I decided to see if I could get away with not taking the life of any of these creatures. It was going to be a tall task because it was full of, particularly aphids and slugs were the big ones. what to do in the Pacific Northwest. I was living in Seattle. And, they seem to flourish with the mild, wet climate. But I undertook that as a training and ended up spending an extra good half an hour, 45 minutes every day in the garden, just going through every morning and picking up slugs, putting them in a little box and taking them to the front yard where I didn't have much of a garden. And it was quite amazing how they just kept on appearing over and over again. And I knew they weren't walking back. I wasn't sure where they would come from. It kind of almost made me believe in spontaneous generation. But soon it became a routine, and you know, I felt good about that. You know, it was kind of a pain sometimes to get up that extra early to do that before going to work, but I found my mind just felt lighter and more at ease. Even though I didn't have a great love for slugs, I didn't have to second guess that anymore. Same with aphids. You know, there would be hundreds of them on a single branch of a rose bush. I liked roses, and I thought, well, God, you know, there's absolutely no way that I can get rid of all of these things by picking them off and carrying them to the front yard. You know, take more than 24 hours a day to do that. But with some effort, I realized that I could get rid of just enough of them in a non-harmful way, that the bush would survive even with some of them still there. They kind of do their damage in masses. So I developed this technique of going to these tender young branches and covered with aphids, and then just holding a box again underneath it and just tapping it, and they would fall off into the box, enough of them anyway, and then I could transplant them to the front yard. And it didn't get rid of them. But it worked in terms of the plant was able to survive. I lost a few, you know, branches here and there every now and then, but it was okay. It made it bearable. So just thinking about that for yourself, you know, how easy it is to reflexively squash that little bug under your thumb when some critter kind of walks into your life that you'd rather wasn't there. And maybe just to pause before following that impulse and ask, is this really necessary? Will my heart be lighter if I maybe just refrain from doing that? Give it a try. Also, I mean, some of what I might say in these reflections might trigger some stuff for people, because we all have lots of experience and views about different aspects of the refinement of precepts, but just to put things out there for consideration, not to try and offer any kind of dogmatic judgmentalism, but just to relate a story recently too of a friend of ours in White Salmon whose dog was passing away over a kind of a long period of time, and she decided to opt to see it through without taking it to the vet for euthanasia. And it wasn't an easy choice because friends and family were saying, you know, you know, it's just, you're just prolonging the suffering. Wouldn't it be kinder, out of compassion, to put this dog out of his suffering? And it's a hard one to argue against. And you know, who knows in some cases, but her conviction was, let's see this through. You know, I want to see if this can be done in a way that is still compassionate. And, you know, we have no idea what that dog is thinking, you know, and the kind of wish for life that he may have, despite his discomfort. So she saw it through to the end, and I think was quite... felt good about doing that. And so to take these kinds of considerations, how we make assumptions based on certain views, certain experiences, certain ways of viewing the world, we make our choices. But to question our automatic responses is a very, very good thing to do. Similar circumstances might lead to different endpoints and different decisions, but to use the precepts for that purpose, they're a guide, a container, a reference point for us to consider as we go through our lives. So, first precept, not taking the life of living beings. How to refine that, how to use that, how to bring that into one's life in a deeper way. Second precept of not taking that which is not given, pretty clear. And we, you know, I suspect that there aren't too many of us in this room who go and rob things from stores or hold up banks or break and enter into people's houses and steal things. But examining little ways that we maybe justify more refined ways of taking things in a way that aren't, it's not quite on the up and up. You know, things like assuming that we can take certain office supplies from our place of work back to home, or taxes. You know, what? Where do we stretch the line, maybe, in not reporting some kinds of income that we are supposed to report, or taking deductions that, you know, we're maybe stretching the limit a little bit? Examining that. Customs is another way. You know, we're always, you're supposed to declare a certain amount of values going through customs, and there's the old, everybody does it, so, you know, I'm not doing anything different than what everybody else does in terms of not declaring certain things. Little things like that are easy to justify in our mind. Ajahn Amaro used to talk about the internal lawyer always coming up with some sort of good argument why this is okay. So just watching to see if that process happens in little ways around that precept. Could be that the significance of the action isn't all that great in the greater scheme of things, but, you know, how does it sit in the memory when it runs fleetingly through the mind? Does it leave a little bit of regret? Is it a kind of little bit of regret that we can do without? Do we really need to do those kinds of things? The third precept, refraining from sexual misconduct. Yeah, just seeing in your life how that works. Obviously, the very clear ways of honoring a committed relationship and not taking advantage of situations for one's own pleasure that might hurt somebody else. Those are the clear ones. But little subtle ways, too. You know, maybe you're in a committed relationship and you find yourself, you know, at a gathering or with some other people and finding somebody in there who's attractive and engage in a little bit of flirting activity, you know, a little bit of interest kind of perking up there and getting one going a little bit. And then kind of realizing, oh, well, you know, I'm in a committed relationship. I don't want to follow through on this. But just watching that, if there's a habit there, with that kind of engaging with somebody on that level, a little flirtatious behavior, what does that actually feel like? It might give a little bit of a thrill or a little bit of fun for a while, but does it really feel good in the long run? Does it really just stimulate, you know, ideas and desires that better to be left quiet and to channel one's energy into one's committed relationship, if that's what you've got? So looking at little ways that we might play around with that precept. The fourth precept is a big one with speech. Now, there's so many avenues that we can refine our speech around. Obviously, at its core is not telling the truth in gross or subtle ways. It's all pretty clear that conscious intentional lies give the mind a real jolt when you remember that. It just does not feel good, even for many years afterwards. I still remember way back in my, maybe around the age of 20 or so, of consciously telling a story around or a lie around a state of repair that my car was in that I was selling. And it's funny how that that memory lingers on, and I got found out. and the kind of backpedaling and you know, hemming and hawing and justifying, and oh boy, you know, it made a very strong impression. And how painful something like that can be. Just also in more subtle ways, one has to be very careful with when one's sharing information that's truthful, but maybe how's the timing? There's a lot of different aspects of right speech. I find myself right in this very, these past month or two, in the middle of one of those considerations with my own mother, who's living in assisted living now, but is really at the point where she needs to have 24-hour care in a nursing home. And her moving from her apartment a year ago, into assisted living was quite traumatic for her. It took her a couple of months to adjust. And so both my sister and I are just kind of cringing at the thought of having to move her again, especially to a 24-hour care facility. So, and she's moderately, she's got moderate dementia, so she forgets things very quickly, but she still registers things on an emotional level quite strongly. So as we're looking at nursing homes, and at my last visit, we visited a number of them, and talking with people about all this, getting medical records together, et cetera, how much to tell mom? Is it not being true? Is it being untruthful by not sharing it and letting her prepare for it? Inevitable as it probably is. Or is it just going to cause unnecessary concern and upset? What's our motivation? Are we just trying to avoid a difficult conversation? Or are we really concerned for her welfare? So all of these considerations come into a decision about whether to tell the truth or not, or withhold information. But I find it's useful to reflect on some of the Buddhist teachings about right speech, and that truth is clearly a paramount factor, and one should never consciously tell a lie. But also timing is important as to when to tell the truth or share something with somebody. And after a lot of consideration and thinking, Gail, my sister, and I agreed that this wasn't the time, that probably a very likely scenario, because we don't know if it's going to be in 1 month or 2 months or 6 months when a place opens up at the chosen nursing home, and that if we were to do it now, tell our mother about it now, that it's quite possible, quite likely, I think, in our judgment anyway, that she would register it, get very upset and confused, and then kind of not be able to process it because of her moderate dementia, maybe forget the actual content but still hold on to the emotional quality of anxiety or fear. And we thought, it just doesn't seem right to put her through that possibility, and that better to tell her the truth at a time when it's much more imminent, but with still some preparation time, you know, not the same day or anything like that, but give her some, you know, couple of weeks or a few weeks to repetitively get used to the idea, rather than causing her months of anxiety for which she can't really process or understand. So these are nuanced ways of that we have to consider dealing with these precepts, particularly around what to tell somebody, truth telling, when to tell it, and making sure that people are in the best frame of mind to receive different kinds of information, truthful information. Other aspects of speech that can always be refined are, of course, the qualities of harsh speech. When we speak out of anger, that process of learning when it is we need to just refrain from speaking, if there's an emotional underlayment going on inside of us, how to just say no to what you really want to blurt out because you'll regret it later and it won't do any good in the long run. So practicing conscious restraint of harsh speech until emotions die down and one can speak from a bit more space of kindness and clarity. That takes constant refinement for a long time, I think. Idle chatter, sampapalapa in the Pali, that's a great word, sampapalapa. Sounds just like what it means. You know, how much time do we just spend kind of nattering? because, you know, it just feels that we're bored or want some stimulation or some interaction with somebody and looking for a little bit of interaction. Or we're just uncomfortable with silence, being with people or a person. Sometimes that welling of somebody got to say something, it's too quiet here. And so you just kind of start nattering. And to watch the effect on the mind that constant speech has. People, you know, constantly talking, chattering, going on and on and on about not too much. It's an energy drain for yourself if you're doing it, and for others if they're part of it as well. So watching that tendency, allowing silence to be there when there's really nothing to say, and learning how to be comfortable with that. And maybe just sitting there with somebody else and dwelling in thoughts of kindness. You know, people can pick up on that vibe. Doesn't have to be spoken. So little ways of refining these precepts. The fifth precept isn't so much a moral precept on refraining from intoxicants, but watching how you may use them. You know, there's probably a number of people who follow the first four precepts, but who feel that it's not a violation, not a problem, really, in any moral way, and it isn't to have a glass of wine or a couple of beers or whatever, you know, when one wants to. But to question yourself, well, why am I doing that? This is a refinement of how we use these precepts. Maybe you're not somebody who uses intoxicants all the time to dull the mind, but even little bits. Just a question to use that as a point of reference. Why am I doing this? Here I am drinking a glass of wine with dinner. Is it because I, you know, want to just relax after a long day, or is there social pressure? If I say I don't want to do it, are people going to think I'm kind of weird? What is it that is the motivating force behind it? If it's just to kind of unwind and relax after a busy day, then Well, watch to see how often that happens, and what is it that I'm doing during the day to make it so that I need to wind and relax on a regular basis with the help of a substance? Are there ways to prevent that from even coming up as an issue? So calling into question how we might be dealing with and justifying and working with some of this business around taking intoxicants. So these are just some refinements along the lines of sila to consider as you go into the back into the daily life outside the monastic routine here. Other aspects of practice that can take reflection, you know, where am I getting complacent? Just the little practices around generosity. Lungpa was talking about that lovely story of you know, someone, the man who was poor in materialistic ways but didn't feel like he was wanting or lacking in any way. So you know, practicing of giving generosity isn't limited to people who have, you know, sufficient means materialistically. There's other ways to give from the heart, time, attention, care, kindness to others. And one can feel very much replete with giving along those lines. And not to hold back when you're able to offer that. He told this, Lungpa told the story of the village kids and adults as well, the sharing of the Pepsi. And I was, when he was telling that, I was remembering also Ajahn Amaro has a corollary to that story that I always found very touching too, and that as I remember it anyway, Ajahn Amaro once asked one of the village kids who was doing that, you know, when he was there, saw the sharing of the Pepsi or the candy or whatever it was, and asked one of the kids, you know, well, why is it that you do share it all with somebody else? And the child looked up very clearly and said, well, it just tastes better when you share it with somebody. And I thought that was a very lovely reflection, lovely image. It tastes better. So just to reflect on the joy that comes from giving in that way, I remember it's kind of a reflection both on generosity but maybe even more on relinquishment. When I was before I was a monk, I was serving a winter retreat at Amaravati, and I got a care package back from the United States, and in the care package were a number of Cadbury fruit and nut chocolate bars. And I would always reserve some time after the meal ended to enjoy some of those, but was realizing that oftentimes the meal during the winter retreat would end perilously close to 12 o'clock. And I was, you know, very careful about following the precepts of not eating after 12, and found myself often kind of making a beeline back to my room to be able to stuff in a few pieces of Cadbury fruit and nut before noontime. And after doing that for a few days, realizing that, oh boy, you know, there's a lot of stress around this. And you know, of course I could have had it before the meal, but I thought, you know, maybe I'll just see if I can you know, it's just like, this is a real good lesson in you know, trying to enjoy something and making yourself miserable. So I ended up just deciding, give it away, give it to the kitchen, and they can put it out at the mealtime. And I'm not sure if it was a partial act of generosity, but probably more of a motivation, one of my first attempts at actual renunciation. And but it felt good on both counts. So just watching the mind when we engage in these kinds of habits, And how can we refine our giving and our also giving up, giving over, relinquishing that which is causing us pain, even in the small ways. And then, of course, in our meditation practice, when we often, without the structure of retreat or group practice, or say for us, life in a monastery and our routines and constant encouragement to develop our meditation, sometimes it's easy, I think, without the formal structures to cut corners, let practice slide, too tired tonight, had a rough day, I need my 8 hours of sleep, so I can't really get up enough early enough in the morning to practice before going to work. All the little ways that we can let things miss for a day or 2 days, 3 days, a week, a month, a year. and to just question, is that what we really want to do? Are we letting ourselves slide? It's easy to do given certain circumstances, and it can be a slippery slope. So making that determination, how do I really want to spend my life? What can I do to increase the amount of time I spend increasing wholesome qualities, decreasing unwholesome qualities? Is it more beneficial for me now that it's 8:30 at night and I've had my meal? Is it beneficial for me to kind of go and switch on the tube and watch it a little bit just to relax and unwind and catch up on the news of the day? Or would that be better time, more well spent, sitting in meditation? And even if the mind is kind of churned and putting out all sorts of memories of the day, just as Lumpa again was saying about the man who moved back to Bangkok, and no matter what his state of mind was, he sat himself down in front of the shrine and paid respects to Ajahn Chah, the Buddha, and just sat there, even if his mind was not settled. Establishing those kinds of habits are much more useful in the long term than just relaxing, chilling out. So really giving yourself a look over when these things are happening and asking yourself some honest questions, very useful. Sometimes I think all of us get caught up in some of our own shortcomings, where our old habits seem impossible to move out of, get entrenched in some difficult mind states. Habits of sensual desire or ill will, anxiety, fear, these kinds of mental states, depression even, can be very, what almost seems to us like intractable sometimes. You think, oh, I've been dealing with this for years. Where am I going with this? Why is there no change? And we forget to see that there are subtle changes in many of these aspects of our underlying tendencies. It's hard to see change over a long period of time. But to really reflect and remember, bring to mind that change isn't only inevitable, but change for the positive is quite possible. We have this capacity for conscious change, conscious choice, as Debbie was talking about in Lumpa this morning. We have the capability of, as the picture in the hall says, of adjusting our sails. Even though the wind may be blowing in a certain direction, we can't change the direction of the wind, but we can adjust our sails to ride with the winds that come our way. And that change is always possible for the better if we direct our mind. It may not happen in quite the fast, quick way we would like it to, but it is possible. Even dramatic change is sometimes possible. I was just reading a book that I was quite surprised when it came to a certain passage. The book is called Being Wrong, and it's about the human, the fact that we all make mistakes, and the errors kind of built into the system, and how we resist that notion of being wrong in many, many different ways. But a section that I was just recently reading on transformation was referring to a series of events that happened in Durham, North Carolina, right at the time that I was going into high school, 1970. I was 15, and it was a time when there was finally, North Carolina was way behind the curve on the desegregation orders of the schools. The Supreme Court had ruled, I think it was like some 16 or 14 years before, a significant amount of time before that, that it was not legal to consciously segregate schools based on race. And North Carolina, where I was growing up, was quite behind in following through on this desegregation. And I was in the Durham City public schools at the time, and there were two high schools, Durham High School and Hillside High School. And Durham High School was where my brother and sister had gone and was predominantly white. Hillside High was predominantly black. And in 1970, it was finally coming about that North Carolina was finally complying with the orders. And so I entered the 10th grade, which is when high school began then, and ended up going to this formerly all-black high school and made up part of the 25% white minority in the newly integrated schools. So it was quite a profound experience, quite an eye-opening experience, because I grew up in a very liberal household, but also somewhat protected from all of what was going on in the world around us in that little community. So, you know, it was quite an eye-opening experience. I certainly learned a lot myself, but kind of unbeknownst to me at the time, at the age of 15, I wasn't following all the news all that clearly, but there had apparently been some seed money from the federal government to offer a series of workshops to help the citizenship of Durham integrate this idea of integrated schools, fearing that there may be some conflict and difficulty with it, and some even possibly some violence. And so there was, it was just a small amount of money, but $70,000 was allocated to provide some seminars and forums for the citizenship of Durham to get their minds around this thing that was about to happen. And one of the organizers of those events realized that he needed to have the cooperation of the community leaders in these forums to get people to accept that this was going to happen and to do it in a peaceful way, constructive way. And so after some consideration, he decided that he wasn't going to be able to get some of the very conservative white people to be able to accept this unless he had the participation of their leadership. And at that time, North Carolina happened to be one of the biggest strongholds of the KKK. I think there was, you know, numerous chapters of it in North Carolina, and was actually thriving quite strongly during that time. And what he decided to do was to have the leader of the Klan in Durham, of the Durham chapter, invite him to participate in those seminars. And at first, there was resistance, but this Klan leader had been actually considering whether or not some of his approaches in trying to protect I'll step back a minute, in that he had grown up very poor, underprivileged, white, lower class in Durham, and had a very hard life, and bringing up a family and not being able to meet their needs very well, and had kind of developed this whole persona around, you know, the enemy being the black people, and was promoted, you know, up the ranks of the Klan, and found some personal self-esteem from that position. But he had started to realize that, you know, his goals of trying to better his family's needs through participation in this were, he wasn't sure that it was actually doing what it should be doing, but still held very tightly to his prejudice, his racial prejudices, in a very, very angry way. But agreed to participate in these seminars, and as a representative, you know, to represent his constituency. And the facilitator of this process also decided that another participant in the process should be this very strong voice activist, a woman named Anne Atwater from the black community in Durham, who was also a community activist in her own community and was involved with dealing with landlord disputes and substandard housing and all sorts of things like that in Durham. And so he actually got the two of them to come to a first planning meeting for these seminars, and apparently the fireworks were quite quite incredible, intense, and you know, a lot of racial name calling that apparently was quite difficult, uncomfortable, threatening, but for some reason. Both of them decided to continue with it, and after a couple of more sessions of organizing and planning, the facilitator decided that these two people should actually be the co-chairs of this process, and again, they agreed to do it. And the first few days were not easy, as one might imagine, but apparently the Klan leader, his name was C.P. Ellis, was just starting to realize that it was going to happen, desegregation was going to happen, and that he might as well try and, for the sake of his community, make the best of it and figure out a way that, you know, he could make it at least tolerable for his children and for the members of his conservative community. And so he, you know, decided to wholeheartedly engage in any way he could, and found himself on maybe it was a third or fourth night, staying after one of the seminars with Anne Atwater, the black leadership, leadership community person, and found themselves talking about their families and their children, and the struggles that they had both had, and it was a watershed moment for Ellis in that he clearly saw that the issues that he was dealing with were absolutely no different than the issues that she was dealing with, and that the only difference was the color of their skin. And apparently he just broke down in tears. And to his surprise and to her surprise too, he just, everything, all of his defensiveness, all of his years of holding his prejudices just started to dissolve, completely melt away. And he essentially was a changed man in that few days. And over the course of the 10 days or so of the meetings, he just did a 180 degree turnaround in his whole life, handed in his badge of being the leader of the Klan, resigned from the Klan, and then, you know, then the integration of the schools happened, and I went into the 10th grade, and there's stories around all of that too. But over the next number of years of his life, maybe 20 years or 25 years or so, he started working for a labor union to try and organize some basic working conditions for both black and white people, and remained lifelong friends with Anne Atwater, his former foe, and she even came to his funeral in 2005 and declared her, you know, lifelong friendship with him. So, change is possible. Change is possible. So, you know, if change is possible on that kind of level, more so for what we find ourselves dealing with, I think, when we think that our minds are just so messed up and our approach to life is, you know, difficult, and what's the point, and can I keep going with refining my practice, sticking with this path, watching these relentless habitual mind states arise and pass away, feeling the pain of them, wanting to resist them, not wanting to deal with them. But we realize we don't really have any choice but to keep working with them, and keeping in mind that there is this great capacity for change. Change is going to happen anyway, so why not really put forth the effort, look at our lives, don't get complacent, and keep working little by little, drop by drop, to increase the sanity of our life. So I'll leave that for this reflection.